Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are human brains ill-suited to the complexities of modern life? In evolutionary terms, the Stone Age is very recent history, meaning our brains haven't had much time to change since before the era of 24/7 video, audio, digital, and print communications, multi-million resident metropolises, and personal and professional calendars scheduled down to the minute, weeks and months ahead of time. We seem to juggle it fairly well most of the time, but as my guest will explain, the myriad things clamoring for our attention can take a toll on our focus and our creativity if we don't make a conscious effort to stay on track. Daniel J. Levitin is professor of psychology and behavior neuroscience at McGill University and dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the Minerva Schools at KGI. His new book is The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. Dan, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So this book is ultimately about how our brains pay attention. What exactly have they evolved to pay attention to?
Well, we evolved in a world where information was coming at us much more slowly, and there was a lot less new information around. So we're not very good at dealing with the kind of information overload, the data age, because we weren't evolved to deal with it. We were evolved to deal with a small group of people that we lived with, and we lived with them our entire lives. We might have known a few dozen people. You walk down the streets in a busy major city now, and you can run into 1,000 people in an hour.
Yeah, we take in really an astonishing amount of information in a typical day in the 21st century.
We do. We take in 5 times more information now than on average than we did in 1986, and that's the equivalent of 174 newspapers cover to cover. In our leisure time alone, we take in 30 gigabytes of information, and we're assaulted from all directions by facts and pseudo-facts, and one of the problems is that it's hard to tell the difference. It's getting increasingly hard to know what's true and what's not true in all of the data sphere.
So, Dan, we take all that information in. Some of it, of course, flows right back out again. How do we encode whatever it is we happen to remember, to hang on to?
Well, the key to remembering things is there are two aspects. One is we'll remember things that we rehearse over and over again. That's the way most of us remember phone numbers and things like that. That is back in the days when you used to have to remember a phone number. Before you could just program it in your phone. And we remember things that are emotionally important to us. So we remember major world events. We're going to remember Ferguson, Missouri for a long time, as we remember the Space Shuttle Challenger explosion, the assassination of Martin Luther King, assassination of John Kennedy. These are emotional events. Your first kiss is an emotional event, another thing we tend to remember. So we remember things that are emotional and things that we rehearse.
So if our strategy for retrieving whatever information we have hung on to is not just the same as, you know, the process of remembering in reverse, how does it work? How do we find the things that we recall?
Well, that's a great question. What's happening in the brain is that most of the things that we remember are there somewhere. Some of them are, well, all the things we remember are there somewhere, and many, many other things that we didn't think we'd remember are there. The problem is, how do you get them out? And we use things called retrieval cues. So a retrieval cue can be a song that you haven't heard in a long time that reminds you of a particular time or place, or it can be a pointed question. I might ask you to focus on what your grade 6 classroom looked like, and think for a minute about where you sat and who your teacher was, and that could eventually bring up a flood of memories that you hadn't recalled before, because that simple act of visualization functions as a retrieval cue.
What does our brain file things into categories?
It does, but the categories turn out to be very flexible. So I'll give you an example. Think about a fire truck. What's the first thing that you think of?
Oh, I guess the flashing lights.
Flashing lights. So what other vehicles have flashing lights?
Police cars, tow trucks, those are the top of mind.
Okay, so we have this kind of category now of vehicles with flashing lights or maybe emergency vehicles. What's the other thing? What's another thing you think about when you try to visualize a fire truck?
Oh, the long red truck and the ladder on the side.
So it's red. Mm-hmm. So things that are red. What other things are red? Tomatoes, apples, blood, a sunset sometimes, right? Hmm. Vehicles with ladders on them, fire trucks, the telephone repair truck, maybe a roofer. So we're able to get at all of these things using different retrieval cues, so that if I had said to you, tell me, name a kind of vehicle that has a ladder on the side, to be able to generate a list.
So does the system our brains use naturally compare with the artificial systems that we've created to retrieve information, say, on the internet or in card catalogs or in any other system of processing information?
What a great question. This has been the holy grail in computer science, is to build a computer that can access information the way that humans do. And there were some big advances about 30 years ago, and then things have slowed down a lot. One of the things that we have that computers lack, of course, computers can store a lot more than we can, and they can store it in a way that it's not distorted. You and I haven't talked about it yet, but many times when we retrieve a memory, we retrieve a distorted version of it without knowing, and it's only later that we discover our memory is false or somehow misleading. And we can certainly talk about that if you like, but to answer your question, what the computers don't have is world knowledge. The computer doesn't know how to put the information together or how to apply the information in a real setting. So if you say to a computer, what goes on a hamburger, it only knows based on hamburgers it's encountered before. It obviously doesn't have any taste or preference or new ideas about that. If I told you I made a hamburger with potato chips on it and you like the idea, that would make sense to you but not to a computer.
Hmm. So in other words, you can think up an idea for a hamburger that might work and that I can picture when you describe it to me that a computer wouldn't be able to figure out.
Yeah, so a classic problem with a computer, the computer scientists deal with is, you load up a computer with all kinds of data, and you can ask it things like, what happened on April 4th, 1967, or what was the Beatles' 10th album? And it can answer that kind of stuff. But it doesn't have real-world knowledge, like what is a birthday party?
Hmm.
What kinds of things happen at a birthday party? What foods go well with hamburgers? It knows that stuff if you program it in. But it can't put together things that it acquires the way that humans do.
So let's talk for a minute about these incorrectly encoded memories. We've all done this, right? You remember your childhood bedroom and you're pretty sure that the bedspread was red and the walls were white or something. And then you see a photograph and you realize they're the opposite. How do we make those mistakes? And what does that say about the kind of meaning that we attach to things that we do remember?
Well, this is a bit of a mystery to neuroscience that memory is, in fact, so labile, so distortable. One explanation is that memories have to be that way because we're a social species, and we agree on certain things by social convention. So we might agree not to talk about that incident with Uncle Irving at the party. And so every time I bring it up, somebody might correct me and say it never happened. This is an important kind of social glue. Another example is that 10 people may experience an event differently. And when we compare notes, I want to have an accurate understanding of what actually happened. And so I may need to modify my memory. And we've seen in the laboratory that if we ask somebody to retrieve a memory, we correct it based on facts or based on an authoritative opinion. When they retrieve the memory much later, they retrieve it the way it's been corrected and don't always remember that they had a prior version of it.
One thing that's always fascinated me, and this might take us a little off topic, but I have you here, so I want to ask it. When I read a novel that's written in the first person, I can often remember that novel. Sometimes I can remember scenes or even sentences from it, but I never mistake that first person account with something that I have done or experienced. I don't think I ever make that error. Why is that?
Well, we have, most of us, when our brains are functioning properly, a mechanism that helps to keep track of ourselves. It's in the prefrontal cortex, in a tiny region just behind the above your eyebrows and behind your temples. And it keeps track of you and what you're doing, and it knows that the things that happened to you didn't happen to someone else. And in fact, it knows that some things that happened to you only happened in your mind. It distinguishes, again, when it functions properly, it distinguishes a dream from, you know, something that actually happened in a waking state. You know, if I dreamed last night that you owe me $10, and I can't distinguish that from reality, our conversation might go very differently right now if you didn't pay up. So that's adaptive, and but it doesn't always work. In people with schizophrenia, it's not clear who's who and who's doing the talking and who's experienced what. And you may remember the incident with President Reagan where he falsely recalled being a fighter pilot, confusing his own movie role with his own life. And so, again, it's when you're reading fiction, you identify with the character and you can remember the scenes because you're imagining that you are him or her, but you're not mistaking that imagining with real life.
Okay, if I go to the grocery store and I need 7 things, I can usually recall what's on that list without too much trouble. But you say it's actually better to just write it down somewhere. Why is that?
Well, in the organized mind, one of the things I try to do is show the science behind memory and attention and how we can use it in everyday life. And it's now well accepted in our field that you can really only keep 4 things in mind efficiently at one time. Maybe up to 7, and there are some exceptions. But in general, when you try to keep stuff in your head, it's competing for other stuff that you might have in your head. And so we engage, all of us to different degrees, in a process of externalizing. We get stuff out of our heads and we put it in the world. That's what you do when you make an appointment on a calendar, when you write down an appointment on a calendar. Whether the calendar is on the wall or in your phone, it doesn't matter. You're getting it out of your head so that you don't need to keep track of it. And shopping lists are no different. If you want to try and remember your shopping list, that's fine, but it's going to mean you've got less neural capacity for doing things like driving, finding a parking place, or just being, you know, allowing your mind to wander and engage with other thoughts. I think, you know, we've all had this experience that, you know, when your brain feels too full, you feel like each new thing that comes in is going to push out some other thing.
My guest is Daniel J. Levitin, professor of psychology and behavior neuroscience at McGill University and dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the Minerva Schools. We are talking about his new book, The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Daniel J. Levitin, professor of psychology and behavioral neuroscience at McGill University and author of The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Dan, you said before the break that we could be at the grocery store or in the parking lot using a little bit of brain power power to find our way to a parking space, and the rest to let our minds wander. This seems like such a fanciful luxury these days. Why is it so important?
Well, we have two dominant modes of attention in our brains. One is the one we're all familiar with and where we spend a lot of time. It's called the task positive network by neuroscientists, and it's the mode in which we're engaged in a task. We're positively engaged in doing something, and we're undistracted. But we've all had the experience that while we thought we were doing something, we find we're not. You might be reading, your eyes get ahead of you, and you realize you weren't paying attention to what was happening. Or you're driving, and you realize you've gone several miles, and you have no idea what terrain you've just passed. That's this other mode. It's the mind-wandering mode, the daydreaming mode, and it exerts a pull on our consciousness because it's an adaptive way of pulling us out of a brain mode that is neurally depleting. It allows us to basically hit the refresh or reset button in our brains.
And the mind-wandering mode is at least at the heart of a lot of creative thought?
It is. Neuroscientists have taken to calling it the default mode of the brain. It's a brain state that when you're not doing anything else, it's what kicks in. And we're apt to experience our greatest moments of creativity when we're in that mode. Now, why would that be? You think it would be the opposite, right? Well, when you're engaged in a task, you're typically using a kind of logical process to get from one thing to another. Not in all cases, but that's how many of us approach work. And you might run into a problem that you can't solve, and you think about it, and you know, after a while, if you don't have a solution, you take a break. And then maybe you're shopping, or maybe you're sitting on the beach or just exercising, and bang, the solution comes to you, Chris. And this is because your mind-wandering mode has taken over, and it allows the mind to wander. It allows the mind to connect thoughts that hadn't previously been connected, ideas that it didn't see the connections between, and that's where the solution comes from.
And I guess one way that maybe unwittingly we make a little space for this mind wandering is by all the things in our lives that we automate. I'm always ashamed to say I'm a creature of habit, but it does keep me from having to think too hard about, you know, where to find things in the house and what to make for breakfast, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, so however you want to describe it, automation or automatic behaviors, a place for everything and everything in its place, or externalizing, getting things out into the world. What we're talking about here, I think, is being able to organize your life and your time so you have more time, so that you can spend more time with loved ones, spend more time doing leisure and creative pursuits, and more time having fun. If at the end of the workday you feel like you haven't accomplished enough, you're going to only reluctantly, you know, engage in a social activity or a leisure activity. But if you can be efficient at work, or you know, efficient in your hobbies for that matter, it frees you up to do more.
So obviously we have a lot more stuff to keep track of than our ancestors did, and maybe that's part of this. But can you explain why smart people make dumb moves like losing their keys and their cell phones on a regular basis?
Well, yeah, the losing things comes really from trying to juggle too many things, and it doesn't mean if you're losing your keys or your reading glasses or your passport or whatever, your sweater for that matter. It doesn't mean that you're not smart. It doesn't mean that you're losing cognitive capacity or that Alzheimer's is around the corner. It's probably just a function of information overload, having too many things on your mind. All the more reason to externalize. So a key hook by the door to hang your keys on, or a decorative bowl maybe where you put the keys by the front door. If the keys always go there, then you don't have to think about where they are. And not having to think about where they are, it sounds kind of regimented, but it actually simplifies your life in many ways.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We have Gabriel on the line in Denton. Hello, Gabriel.
Hi, Chris. How are you guys doing today?
Great, thank you.
My question is about, it's a great topic, by the way. I think all of us struggle with some parts of our memory, but for those of us who experience synesthesia, how can those things kind of play into improving our memory capacity over longer periods of time? For example, I hear certain songs on the radio every once in a great while, and almost like a movie is playing in front of me. I can tell you exactly where I was when I heard that song, who was there, what they were wearing, what they were eating. You know, just a lot of very vivid, very detailed, almost like a flashback. And I'm just wondering, how does that kind of stuff play into your guest's research?
So you want to harness that, Gabriel. Is that what you're saying?
I want to harness it, but I also want to understand it, because it's something that I've done since I was a kid, but I always felt like I was keeping a secret from everybody.
What do you know about that, Dan?
Well, so Gabriel, our caller, is a synesthete. These are 1% to 5% of the population who experience a merging of two or more senses. And I don't mean this poetically or metaphorically. Some synesthetes, when they hear the note C sharp on the piano, they see red. Others might, when they hear certain vowel sounds or consonant sounds, feel a particular kind of thing on their skin, a particular kind of itch or sensation. Some synesthetes I've encountered associate shapes with tastes. So, you know, bitter might be a triangle and sweet might be a circle, things like that. And I don't mean, again, it's not metaphorical. They actually have a merging of the sensory experiences. And this allows them a lot more access to memory because they've got an additional sensory cue. It's much easier to remember things when they're more vivid because there's more to work with. And I guess the way to harness it is, you know, for keeping order in your life, for keeping track of things that you lose, you can use color coding. If you want to, you know, be able to easily distinguish a house key from an office key, you can buy those plastic rings that go around the key. Choose a color that might be the color of the paint in the office, and that makes it even easier.
I was so happy to hear you, or to read you, extolling the virtues of the junk drawer. I actually have one at the office and one at the house. Why are these helpful?
I interviewed a number of highly successful people for the book. These were Nobel Prize winners. They were scientists and artists, heads of military, and heads of big corporations. And one thing that I learned from talking to them was that they don't waste more time on a decision than it's worth. This is a hugely important principle. So for a CEO, it would obviously be ridiculous to spend 2 hours of a highly paid person's time trying to decide whether the company can save $2 a year on paperclips. But if they could save, you know, $500,000 by leasing versus buying a piece of heavy machinery, that's a decision that's worth the CEO's time. And the junk drawer represents this in microcosm in all of our lives. You've got something in your hand, and you're trying to figure out where to put it. Now, I'm sure, Chris, that there's an ideal location in your house or your basement where to put that thing. But if it takes more than a few seconds of thought to figure that out, what you do is you throw it in the junk drawer and you move on with your life and you don't obsess about it. You know that it's there.
Yeah. And then once every 6 months, I have to deal with it all in a very painful afternoon. But yeah, from day to day, it works really well.
Right. But it represents, Chris, an act of cognitive economy.
Another interesting trick is to create different workspaces for different kinds of tasks that we have. What's the value there?
Well, we were talking earlier about place memory and how we have memory for, you know, where things are in the environment. This evolved from our hunter-gatherer ancestors who had to remember where the well was and where the fruit trees were and things like that. And place memory is so refined that students who study for an exam in a room will perform better if the exam is given in that room than if it's given somewhere else. We associate things with particular places. So if you work on different projects, it can be helpful to have different computers or different computer screens, or at least change the visual look of your computer screen or the different desktop when you move from project to project, because that simple change in environment helps to reinforce the memory cues that went with that project.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Mary in Corinth. Hey, Mary.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Great topic. So my question is, I'm a writer in my 50s, and I write at my laptop, and a lot of it is creative, but whether it is or not, the older I get, the more I tend to forget things. So now I find myself Googling almost everything, and I'm wondering if that's decreasing my brain capacity or if you're saying that's freeing up space that I could be thinking about something else.
Well, so I think this is a beautiful example, Mary, of externalizing. You're allowing Google to be an extension of your memory and of your frontal lobe so that you don't have to remember all these things. Google remembers them for you. You go out and you retrieve the facts as you need them.
So, in other words, the way we think may not be changing, but the way we find information, we don't have to own all that in our heads in order to have access to it.
Right. The problem, of course, these days is separating the digital wheat from the digital chaff.
Right.
So there's a lot of information out there, and it's not all equally good. Suppose you go to Google to find out information about a new medication your doctor recommended, and you find a web page devoted to that very medication, and it tells you about, you know, all of the pluses and minuses and their, you know, patient testimonials and things like that. Well, it's worth stopping a minute and asking the question, who is hosting the site? Is it the manufacturer of the drug? Maybe is it the manufacturer of a competing drug? Can you imagine what biases either of them might bring to the accounts that they choose to show?
When we Google or when we're online surfing around, I mean, sometimes we go to look for one thing and then we get, you know, pulled off in a different direction, you know, 29 celebrities who look like they're cats, and then we, you know, click over there. And I thought in some ways that feels like the process that our brains go through when we're just sitting around thinking about nothing in particular. You know, we go from one flight of fancy to another. The difference is online, somebody's actually feeding you those cues. And when we're thinking about them, of course, we're generating them ourselves. So is there a greater value to sitting around daydreaming unassisted, as it were?
Well, I'm a big believer in serendipity, in the power of serendipity, that is. So I have a number of friends who are songwriters, and they'll be walking down the street, and they'll sometimes will take a different route than they usually do because they want to see and hear different things. And a simple line, spoken by somebody you pass, can become fuel for a creative act, a painting or a song. A famous song by Paul Simon, Mother and Child Reunion, was an entry on a Chinese menu. It was chicken and egg,
huh.
Mother and Child Reunion. So, and he wrote a whole song about that. You know, it kind of happened serendipitously. And so when we browse through the world on our own, we're more likely to have to be encountering things that are unique to us and that may trigger some unique creative moments that you don't get when you're just browsing a kind of pre-digested internet feed.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. We have Juan on the line in Waco. Hi, Juan.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
Well, there's one thing that I've heard a lot about this 10% rule about your brain. You're only using 10% of your brain at any one time. And a movie was recently made about it, Lucy. And I wanted to hear from our guest about the 10% rule, or whether it's a myth or there's some truth to it. But
are we using more than 10%, Dan?
This really is a myth, and a colleague of mine wrote a New York Times piece about it 3 weeks ago in the Sunday Review section. Among neuroscientists, this is a well-known myth, and you're using almost all of your brain all the time. you're not aware of it because a lot of the processes are hidden to you. It's keeping your heart beating. It tells you when you're hungry and when you're thirsty. And, you know, some parts of your brain fall asleep while you're awake. I mean, they kind of go offline for a little bit, like putting the hard disk to sleep, and you don't notice it. But we're using almost all our brains all the time. The trick, I think, is to be able to make your brain more efficient and your time more efficient. And these are the techniques that Chris and I are talking about that I try to reveal in the book, in The Organized Mind. How to organize your time and your social life, your decision-making, and your home and workplaces so that you're making a situation available where you can be maximally creative and productive, which at the end of the day gives you more time to do the things you want to do.
You write that you were struck by the number of super successful, like CEO-level people who walk around with a notebook at all times.
Yeah, so I, especially in Silicon Valley, you know, Sheryl Sandberg, who, you know, arguably is, you know, working at the crown jewel of Silicon Valley companies. She's the COO for Facebook. She writes things down in a notebook. And a lot of highly successful people write things down on paper. Index cards are very popular. There's a couple of reasons for this. The act of writing something down requires you to think about what you're doing in a way that typing doesn't. And so we call it in neuroscience deep processing. The deeper you process something, the better you remember it.
Let me jump in for a second. We have to take a quick break, and we will get the rest of this answer in a moment. My guest is Daniel J. Levitin, professor of psychology and behavioral neuroscience at McGill and dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the Minerva Schools at KGI. His new book, The Organized Mind. We will come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with neuroscientist Daniel J. Levitin about his new book, The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Dan, just before the break, you were telling us about why the physical act of writing with one's hand as opposed to typing triggers something called deep processing.
Right. It takes a little while longer. It requires some motor coordination and motor memory. And so writing it down gets it deeper into memory. The other thing is that if you write things down on index cards, they're very easy to sort and resort as your priorities change throughout the day. If your to-do list is on a few index cards in your pocket and something pops up later that changes the priority, it's very easy to pick up a card and move it around. Not as easy on a computer or a phone or a pad to go down the list of items, cut it, paste it, move it up. It just seems to be more efficient. People enjoy more having the index cards, the people who use them.
We have an email here from Mickey who wants to know, how do the super winners of Jeopardy and Spelling Bees keep so much in their brains?
Well, We differ from one another as humans in thousands of different ways. And, some of us are generous and some are stingy, some are outgoing, some are retiring, some are athletic and some are not. And one of the ways we differ is in the way we retain information and our capacity for retention. This is partly determined by our genes, or influenced, I should say, partly influenced by our environment and neural development. And there are some people who just simply remember things better than others. And I'm sure, we all have encountered people like this. The other thing is that people have different kinds of memory. So some people's memory, for various reasons, is better structured for remembering what you and I might call trivia or fun facts or world knowledge. Other people remember things like social information. They remember names of people, everybody they've met. They remember what they do. Other people might have very good autobiographical memory. They remember where they were and what movies they've seen. So these are all just different manifestations of normal human memory.
So my husband is better at remembering that we need to put new air filters in the HVAC system in our house, and I'm better at remembering that we need to buy a pound of coffee. And it turns out that romantic partners have ways of dividing up the labor of remembering important things. Those are rather minor, but...
This is one of my favorite topics in the book, which is that usually on an unspoken basis, romantic partners divide up the memory load for their couple. So as you say, one member of the couple might implicitly take responsibility for things related to home repair, and another related to the social calendar. One might remember the movies you've seen. Another might remember what you need in the refrigerator next time you go shopping. And it allows us to effectively double our memory capacity because we don't have to keep track of everything. And you see this at parties. Couple goes to a party, they meet somebody new, and a piece of information from that person comes in about an upcoming baseball game or maybe an upcoming concert. And one member of the couple will implicitly take responsibility for remembering that information.
The research about sleep, it becomes more and more interesting the more we learn. Can you speak a little bit about the importance of sleep when it comes to processing information and the use of memory?
You know, we've all heard that you need a good night's sleep, and just like we hear we're supposed to floss. And many of us either don't believe it, or we believe it but we don't do it. And we've obtained in the last decade or so a lot of information on this. Matthew Walker at UC Berkeley has done a lot of the work, as have others around the country. Sleep is important for consolidating memories. And it does a lot of other things, too. But if here you and I are talking about cognitive capacity. The things that happen to you during the day are tossed around in your mind while you sleep. And connections are made between them, and they're categorized in different ways, and they're processed so that you can remember them later. If your sleep is disrupted, or you don't get your normal amount of sleep, or you stay up late, the events of that previous day can be disrupted for weeks or months afterwards.
So there's a long-term consequence to not sleeping right.
There really is, and good sleep hygiene is really important. The experts are right. You should go to the extent possible, you should go to bed at the same time every day, get up at the same time every day. And if you have a bad night, don't try to make up for it by sleeping an extra 3 hours the next night. It's better if you stick to the schedule. This has implications, of course, for people who travel across time zones. And the advice there is to adjust your body clock by 1 hour. One time zone, really, for each day. So if you're going from West Coast time to East Coast time, 3 days before, you start going to bed an hour later. Earlier. Wait.
Well, probably we can outsource that information to Google and figure it out. Let's go back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372. We have Martha on the line in Dallas. Hey, Martha.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
I get my best ideas when I'm walking. Maybe after about 20 minutes, I walk early. Does your guest's research point to any kind of mechanical or cognitive reason for this?
There is a scientific literature on this, that walking in nature in particular, where you see natural things, trees, flowers, shrubs, ponds, creeks, mountains, the ocean, the sky, walking in nature is restorative. And we don't really understand why, but it does allow us to more easily enter that daydreaming mode we talked about earlier in the hour. And that daydreaming mode is apt to be where your most creative work is done.
1-800-933-5372. You can send email as well to think@kera.org. I want to ask you this, though. You know, so many times we feel the need to multitask while we're, say, walking or running for exercise. You know, we're listening to conversational Spanish lessons at the same time or catching up on voicemail. Is there a way to better take care of our thinking time and really insist on carving that out for ourselves? Can we assign ourselves daydreaming time?
You know, I'm having interviewed so many successful people for the book, I was struck by how efficient they are. They really do get a lot more done than the average person. And they do it by partitioning their day. And they allow time for recreation, of course. But they set up a situation where when they're engaged in a work project, they focus on that. They have a very narrowed attentional focus. They put other distractions out of their reach and out of their way. And let's face it, many of them have assistants that help keep distractions at bay. And they sometimes do two things at once. They'll be listening to a book on tape while driving or while exercising, but they still make sure that they get break time. I think we can take a lesson from air traffic controllers. They're mandated to work no more than 45 to 60 minutes and then take a 15 to 30 minute break. And that's because of a recognition that too much focus time and not enough daydreaming or recovery time leads to poor performance. And when I say we should take that lesson, I think in any line of work, having breaks, maybe not as much as air traffic controllers, but breaks throughout the day to just sort of zone out and look out the window are tremendously important.
Let's go back to the phone now and speak with Pete in Arlington. Hello, Pete.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
This topic is particularly important to me. I'll be brief and get to the point with the question, but I have a history of Alzheimer's in the family. And 2 years ago, I was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment. And since then, all of my neurological scores have gone up, and so that I'm no longer in the MCI range. But one of the things that intrigues me, and I want to know how your principles apply, is the difference between recall memory and recognition memory. When I've been taking these tests and they read me a long list of words, I don't do very well on that, but in recalling the ones that I heard. But later on in the session, they'll read me a long list of words, and I'm to say whether or not each word was or was not on the list they read me, and I always nail that perfectly. So how do your principles apply to improving recall memory, and how does this recall and recognition memory really work together?
Interesting question. Thanks, Pete.
That's a beautiful description, Pete, of a distinction that we make between these two different memory systems. And they do seem to involve different neural circuits in the brain. Recall memory in general is more difficult because you have to generate the answer from scratch. Recognition memory, you're shown a list of things and you're asked to pick out the ones you saw before. So multiple choice questions in a classroom are an example of recognition memory. The right answer is there. You just have to recognize which one it is among a number of lures. In almost every case, recognition memory is better than recall. And the way to improve recall memory, if you have the opportunity to do so, is to try and quiet your mind down and to be relaxed and undistracted and really focus on the items when they come in and engage in some kind of deep processing. If you are hearing a list of words, you might imagine how you would use them in addition to just hearing them. So you hear the word hammer, and you might imagine it, you know, picture in your mind of hammering a nail. You hear the word justice, and you might picture the lady holding the scales of justice, that kind of thing.
Is it true that people do better with organizational systems of their own devising than with something that some expert somewhere has come up with that works for them?
Well, in many cases, the research shows that the opposite's true. People do better with the expert system, and it's similar to how it's very difficult to devise your own exercise workout. But as soon as you get a coach, you start making progress. Because you have a process now that's been given to you, and the reason is that the person who devises the system, like you, has a number of competing ideas about how to do it, but since you hired them to give you a system, they carve out the best one they can, individualized, customized for you. You don't have access to all that mental machinery of theirs, of the doubts they had about, well, is this really the best one or not? You just know that they gave it to you and you paid for it. So you tend to put a little more stock in it.
What does all this suggest about the ways that we need to approach education in the modern era?
I think that the way we approach education has to change. We talked a minute ago about separating the wheat from the digital chaff, and I think this is the crux of what we need to do moving forward with education and teaching the next generation of children. This is what I'm doing at Minerva Schools at KGI, a new undergraduate program in California. We're devising an undergraduate curriculum that revolves around critical thinking. So as you pointed out, Chris, now that we can get information from the Internet instantaneously and almost anything that we wanted, as our caller Mary was talking about, the sheer acquisition of information cannot be the goal of education anymore. It has to be shifted. The goal has to be how to critically analyze information, how to detect what is good information and what is bad, and how to use it in a creative way so that we can solve the world's problems.
Do you find that younger people, undergrads, are naturally doing some of this in ways that those of us kind of caught in the middle who are digital immigrants have struggled with?
Well, the so-called digital native generation isn't doing as much critical analysis of data as they could.
Mm-hmm.
And they're much more facile with the technology, but much less aware of some of the distinctions because they've grown up in a world that didn't have the kinds of curators that old fogies like me had. It used to be that if a book was published, it had gone through a certain vetting process. Not all books, but most books had. If a book was in a university library, there was yet another layer of vetting. Some professors and librarians had to decide that it was worthy of having in the collection. Now, information on the Internet, the good stuff that's by experts, competes and in many cases is on equal digital footing with the stuff by novices. And, you know, there are people who really know stuff and there are people who don't and think they do, or people who don't know they don't, but they say it anyway. And trying to separate that out can be really difficult.
Daniel J. Levitin is Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the Minerva Schools at KGI and Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Neuroscience at McGill University. His new book is The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. Dan, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.